Everybody, thank you for joining us here in the second segment. Welcome back. We're talking with Gordon Kennedy about the Guanches and his book, The White Indians of Nivaria. And a lot of interesting points here, of course, we should kind of talk more about and discuss, and in terms of what type of culture they had. And of course, a little bit later, I want to talk about some of the parallels, you know, to what actually is going on today. But the similarities about the cultures is something I think we should talk about. I mean, diffusionism, transcultural diffusionism, I think is a correct technical term for this, but it has to do with this idea that the cultures are have some extraordinary similarities, from the mummification of the Egyptians and the Peruvians, which is something that seems to be then kind of a middle ground here on of the Guanches and the you know, in these island chains. And there's other aspects as well, such as the boat building and the techniques and the, you know, the reed boats, as Heyerdahl proved, and everything else. And then we have the pyramids, which is, of course, a huge one as well. And as we know, there are step pyramids. I think the first one actually is a step pyramid in Egypt, in Saqqara. And a lot of them kind of look the same in the South American continents as well. So what should we assume when we realize the similarities here? Are we talking about a culture that went from, you know, from the east all the way to the west, and this is something that spread with those people? And if so, what is the Guanches' role in this? Did they have a central role in being part of spreading this type of civilization, do you think, or how should we explain some of this?
Well, whatever was going on in the Canary Islands, the hard evidence for what we're finding there are the pyramids, the mummies, a trepanning of the skull, which is a form of primitive surgery, which has a very limited distribution in the world. It was in Eastern Mediterranean cultures, it was in Polynesia, it was in Peru, and it was in the Canary Islands. And there's not too many other places. It was where you'll find a skull that has a little square cut out of it. And some of it has some religious significance, but other times it was just because people had their heads bashed and some surgeon had to come along and try to mend it. And trepanning of the skull is very key. I mean, they were really quite surprised to find trepan skulls in the Canary Islands. But the other thing is, the word canary comes from canine, and it's because there's all these wild dogs in the Canary Islands. And the dogs that they have there look like an Anubis. They look like these Egyptian kind of a dogs. And the Guanches used to mummify dogs too. There's been plenty of dog mummies found. And there's also dog mummies found in Peru and in Mexico. And the types of dogs the Aztecs and the Mayans and the Incas mummified were this Anubis type of a dog. And this is not a dog in America that has any kind of a wild progenitor. It was sort of like the wild dogs that you find in the American continent tended to be more like a husky type, and they could have come across from Siberia with the native people. But these Anubis looking dogs were the ones that were mummified. And again, that's one common feature in the Canary Islands. But there was a lot of, it's hard to say what was going on, but it must have been literally thousands and thousands of crossings of the Atlantic Ocean by people that were very capable of setting up some colonies. Right on the African coast in Morocco, in a place called Lixus, there's some stone monuments there that are just something like out of ancient Mesopotamia or what the Incas were doing in Tiahuanaco. I mean, this is just like just giant stone blocks at a harbor there. And that was some kind of a harbor that the Phoenicians used. And what the Canary Islands were right within that current, it was a perfect place to kind of hide out, to get food growing. Whoever these people were, that they were placed there in prehistory, almost certainly had ties with whoever knew how to sail in those days, which would have been the Sumerians and the Phoenicians. And this cult, that this solar symbolism cult, this business that's going on with these pyramids and stuff. Wherever the center of civilization was found in America, it didn't seem to have any early developments. It arrived fully mature, and later variants were just were developed by the people that were living there.
Yeah,
there didn't seem to be any local evolution anywhere. I mean,
so it's kind of a rise and then a kind of a quick fall. And then, of course, we do have the stories of, if you look at many of the South American cultures, at least, they talk about them basically kind of moving into these areas and starting to live there. But the accounts is very clear in some cases where they say that we did not build this. This is something else. So what's your take on the Olmec civilization then, where we seem to have a lot of different features from a lot of different cultures, and that they possibly were over there? Some of these people were probably viewed as, you know, semi-gods to a certain extent, and they possibly came with the arrival of, you know, architecture and managed to build some of these extraordinary things that we see in South America. What's your take on that?
Yeah, the Olmec seems to be one of the oldest, and the Olmec is just kind of a word for a people that they don't even really know who they were. But it seems to that the Mayans and the Aztecs borrowed an awful lot of what they had from the Olmecs. And you can see statues. The first person to discover these African-looking heads within in Mexico was Jose Melgar, and that was in 1862. It was a place called Hueyapan, which is now Tres Zapotes. And there's like these very large mammoth stone heads that are massive, you know, and they were quarried 60 miles away or something like that. And they have, we refer to them sometimes as baby face. They have kind of African features. And within the same region there, we have also what are what's called the Uncle Sam type. And that's the bearded looking figurines with these very Semitic looking noses and long hair and a kind of like a long garment, like a, you know, some kind of reached all the way down to their feet. And the Mormons are really big on this kind of stuff because they're always trying to find connections between the Book of the Mormon and the Hebrews, the ancient Hebrews and stuff like this.
Right.
And maybe some of the things that they've dug up actually have some validity to it, because they certainly have a bigger budget than I do. And I've certainly looked at some of their books, and they come up with some amazing pictures. One thing in particular was that I watched a video called Ancient Ruins of America by some Mormon who went down there, and he went on a 35,000 mile trip. And he had pictures of wheels in there from ancient Mexico, giant wheels with like axles, where there were square axle holes that were made out of stone and everything like this. And see, what we're taught in schools is that there nobody had discovered the wheel in America. But there's also these little clay figurine toys, you know, with the same thing they found in Mesopotamia, of little dogs that are on wheels that were made out of ceramics and they were fired. And so we have that. But there are so many details that were common to the Fertile Crescent and to the New World. I mean, things like pyramid building, sun worship, marriage between brothers and sisters in royal families, mummification, the wearing of false beards amongst priest kings, trepanning of the skull, written script, calendar systems, the use of zero, irrigation and terrace agriculture, spinning and weaving, pottery, megalithic masonry, the sling, the birdman deities, musical and wind instruments, reed boats, fishing hooks, mural paintings and relief carvings, brick manufacture, paper manufacture, ceramic stamps, wheel toys, circumcision were practiced, which seems kind of odd, you know. It was actually an isolationist, a pretty well-known isolationist named John Howland Rowe, who worked up at Berkeley. He was a professor up there, and he published an article in 1966 called Diffusionism and Archaeology, and he's himself a hardcore isolationist. He doesn't believe in Heyerdahl's theories. He doesn't believe in diffusion at all. But he compiled a whole massive list, and I have that in my book, of all of these details that were common to the Andes and to the Eastern Mediterranean. And so it's almost like he proves the point himself. But he mentions one detail, and it was something that Heyerdahl mentioned too, and it has to do with basically cotton. And it's pretty well known that the Egyptians and the Sumerians cultivated cotton. And the types of cotton that were cultivated in the New World were, it was an old world strain that had 13 chromosomes that had been crossed with a wild cotton from the New World that had 13 chromosomes. And the result was a cotton that had 26 chromosomes. And so somebody, I mean, I don't know how they can explain this in academia, but they would almost have to say that a bird carried the cotton seeds in his mouth across the Atlantic Ocean and dropped them on the beach. And somebody was standing there on the beach and knew just what they were. So they crossed them with an American strain that had 13 chromosomes. Then it became a new strain with 26 chromosomes. And then after they got the cotton growing, then they invented the loom and the spindle so they could weave clothing in the hottest part of America where you don't even need clothing, you know?
Right.
talking about plants, for example, that's hard evidence. Like, it's one thing to invent something like a pyramid or mummies or false beards or masonry or pottery or things, but you can't invent plants. See, there's no way a plant is going to make itself across the Atlantic Ocean unless somebody carries it in a boat. And there were several things. One of them was bottle gourds, and one of them was the garden bean that they found that the Greeks cultivated, Phaseolus vulgaris, and they found them in Peruvian tombs too. So somebody in ancient Peru was growing the same beans that they were in Greece. And bottle gourds, there's things like this that, and these dogs too. I mean, why would they have this Anubis-looking dog? It looked like an Egyptian kind of a dog that they're mummifying in Peru. You know, I'm virtually certain that somebody brought those over. What they're saying is that they say that it wasn't carrying in a bird's mouth that somehow managed to float across the Atlantic Ocean all by itself. You know, it floated across and then somebody saw it on the beach and the cotton can float across the ocean or the beans, but a boat can't float across with human beings.
Right, exactly.
The boat won't make it. But I think amongst all of these, the hardest evidence of all is the cotton. You know, it's not the mummies or the pyramids. It's firstly the fact that Egyptians and Sumerians, cotton was cultivated in Eastern Mediterranean Fertile Crescent thousands of years before Aztec, Incas, or Mayas ever even existed. It was a common plant over there. They knew how to cultivate it. And somebody brought it to the New World and said, this is what you need to do with it. And then they invented the loom and the spindle. To this day, we're up in the mountains in Bolivia, and you can see these Bolivian Indian women with these, you know, weaving things on their looms. And, you know, this is a legacy of the Incas, who, by the way, came much later. The Incas basically hijacked the civilization that these other people had created.
Yeah.
Time before that, you know, the Incas were the tyrants, really, and that they even admitted themselves that when Pizarro got there, said, we didn't really build all of this, Tiahuanaco and, you know, Lake Titicaca. This was somebody else that came before us. And all of the evidence points to the fact that these were basically light-skinned people. They came from the land of the sunrise, somewhere from the east, and that the Canary Islands was just part of this passage. I mean, what connection? I mean, we're talking about 90 generations or something of Guanches that came and went. And by the time we found them in the 15th century, they didn't really have too much of a recollection of what had gone on. They just knew that there was a vicious world out there somewhere because everybody that showed up wanted to kill them or take their women or something, you know. So, you know, they just had to deal with the matters at hand with the Spanish or the Portuguese or the French or maybe before that the Romans or who knows who. But for those generations and those periods in history when there were those transatlantic voyages, when people were going from the coast of Morocco to the New World and setting up these colonies and these civilizations and these empires, Canary Islands was certainly something that was going on. It may have been just a food production facility or a safe harbor, or it may have been a trading area where they were bringing and taking people and making them leave and stuff like that. But I think just the same thing that happened in America, slaves eventually want to break out, just take off, and that's what they did, you know.
Right.
So.
Very interesting. Now, does this, in your view, does this change a lot of the history of the Americas, the American continent as well? I mean, we know, for example, about Clovis culture. There are other, the Solutrean hypothesis that the first Americans, you know, arrived many, many thousands of years ago, speculated anywhere between 13,500 years ago, all the way as back as 17,000 years ago. And some of the evidence for this is, of course, in the unique tool-making technique that was used in around France and Portugal that later then showed up in the Americas. But if there's been these constant kind of migrations over to the continent, that does kind of upset things a little bit. I mean, because we know, for example, as I mentioned earlier at the end of the first segment, about the Viking expeditions there. And I mean, it seems to me that the whole Christopher Columbus thing is just kind of a big ruse, really. It's like a big theatrical play as opposed to, those who actually genuinely, you know, discovered the continent. Because I think you have a little bit of that in your book as well, that it might have been plenty of white tribes over in the Americas, even when the Spanish and Portuguese got there. You have stories of, Lewis and Clark, for example, talking about this kind of stuff as well. We have stories of, red-haired people and everything, right? So it seems to have been, in other words, this is something that's been going on for a long time. yet this kind of official story is just something that just kind of clings on like a bad parasite and doesn't really let go, you know?
Right. Well, if they can make the white man the adversary, I mean, if they say that everything bad after Columbus got here, if everything bad happened after that, then I think the blame would go on Columbus and everything before him and that came from Europe, and that they can draw the line right there. But if they had to say that somebody was here before that, like the Solutrean 17,000 years ago, or that if there was these other migrations that set up these empires and these colonies 2,000 to 3,000 years ago from the Sumerians and the Phoenicians, and they had people all over the place. I mean, one of the books that I tell people to read is a book called To the American Indian by Lucy Thompson. And she was the second woman ever to write a book about Native American culture. And she's a full-blooded native from up in the Yurok tribe in northwestern California near Arcata. And it published in 1917. And she's got a chapter in there, just a very short, simple chapter called To the Ancient White People, Traditions of the Ancient White People. And it's like only 6 or 7 pages. And she describes these people that were like basically taught them how to build their fish traps and all kinds of things. They just learned all kinds of things. They say they were wonderful, delightful people. But then in the 19th century, when they saw these new white people showing up again, these prospectors and these 49ers, they thought it was the Wagas coming back. That was the name they had for these ancient.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, but then they just, these new white people were just doing horrendous things, you know, and so they, well, that's obviously not them, you know. But you could pass this book to like a feminist at some lefty bookstore or something up there and ask them to explain that. And they get kind of upset, you know, because everything about the book seems politically correct, because there's a picture of a beautiful Native woman on the cover. She's full-blooded. You know, she's a female. She's the second Native American female to write a book about her culture. Everything else in the book sounds like it's hard anthropology. She's got good pictures, but she's talking about these white people that were there. So the only explanation that a lefty liberal feminist could come up with is something like, well, they must have been spirit beings. Like it was just somehow in their imagination.
Right.
Just in physical form. Or else they were somebody that were painted or whatever. They couldn't actually, see, they want to go to every extreme to prove that they couldn't actually have been living physically Caucasian.
Exactly. You know? Because that changes everything. That complicates the story and make things more questionable, you know?
This is just one example of just hundreds. I mean, there's a Chepotule tribe in Panama. There's this book written called The White Indians of Darien in Panama. And right there at what was basically the junction of the two hemispheres, you know, where the northern hemisphere meets the southern hemisphere and the Pacific Ocean meets the Atlantic Ocean, right where we put the Panama Canal. Just south of there, there's an area called the Chuquanaque River. And the valley's about 25 miles wide and 150 miles long. And on one side, in the Atlantic Ocean side, you got a mountain range about 3,000 to 4,000 feet. And on the other side, on the Pacific side, you got a mountain range. So it's a pretty isolated little spot. And this guy named Richard Marsh was there in the 1920s, and he found an entire tribe of white Indians living down there. And they'd been there for a long, long time. And he wrote a book about it. And the book has gone up in price now. It's very hard to find. But it's just a remarkable story. It's unbelievable. And he's got photographs there and there and everything. And he knew that in the 1920s, people were going to be doubting him. So he brought a whole expedition down there of scientists, archaeologists, anthropologists, newspapermen, you know, botanists, everybody on this expedition. He needed to tell us the whole story. And then he took three of the Indians back to America to the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, and he had all the scientists. It was parades of everybody from academia was looking at him, geneticists, you know, even Ernest A. Houghton, who was one of my favorite anthropologists. He wrote Ancient Inhabitants of the Canary Islands. You know, he had a look at them. And they were trying to decide whether they were albinos or something, you know. But apparently they didn't have all the features that albinos have. They didn't have pink eyes, and they didn't have, like, pure white hair. They had blonde hair. They looked just like Europeans, you know. So they were mixed with some of the native people around there that were darker, too. You could see it in their features. But there was at least 2,000 of these Indians that were living there. And that's exactly where they would have been, too, in some remote valley where they could fight themselves off from the rest of the world. Even when the Spanish arrived in the 15th century, the Spanish had a really hard time with them. But the other Indians around there that were darker, they had such a hard time with the Spanish. After they got, you know, dealing with the Spanish, they started attacking the white Indians too, because they say, well, you look just like them, so we're going to kill you too. You
know?
So the other Indians that were around there began to associate the Spanish with these white Indians, so they were getting it from everywhere. And then somewhere after the 40s or the 50s, the Mormons were getting on there and baptizing them, and because that fits within, the Mormons have all this thing about the Nephites and the Lamanites, and the Lamanites were dark-skinned, and the Nephites were white-skinned, and they thought these were descendants of these Nephites, these people that were in the Book of the Mormon, and that they wanted them to baptize them, so make them part of the Mormon church and things like that. But I don't think there's any of them left by now. I'm sure they're all gone by this point. But in Brazil, there's stories of white Indians. Humboldt found white Indians. Cortez found white Indians. Columbus found white Indians. They were all over the place. And I think the Salutrian theory makes pretty good sense, and the movie that's come out, it's interesting, but I think it's not even the spear points that are hard evidence. I think it's the skulls that they found, because Asiatic skulls have a kind of round form, whereas like Indo-European skulls tend to be long, and they have found a lot of Indo-European skulls all over the place, not just North America, but Central America and South America, that are not what you'd call Asiatic looking skulls, that are round. These are more like some of the oldest skulls of all, 15,000 years old.
Yeah.
Are European skulls, and that's probably the best evidence for this, something like a Salutrian migration that was, they were hunting seals across the Atlantic Ocean and follow the ice bridges, you know, that very likely could have happened. And yeah, that would change history too, you know. And so if we're being lied to, you know, again, it wasn't my intentions to create controversy and start fighting. I mean, again, my main theme was that the world we live in now is an empire. I'm living in the American empire.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at what's going on here right now. And just like a modern day Hopi or a Navajo or a Lakota or something would say, wouldn't it be great, you know, to be able to go back the way their ancestors live? And they take a lot of pride in who they are and everything like that. And they know what's happened with the white man and all the things that have happened over here. But if you took a Lakota or a Hopi or a Navajo or somebody and brought them over to the Canary Islands in the 15th century, they probably would have fit right in. They'd probably say, hey, this is pretty good, man. You guys have got a good setup here, you know. So it doesn't have to do with necessarily race or ethnicity. I mean, these were just different white people that have taken a different migration and different direction in history. And the other people like the British and the French and the Portuguese and the Spanish had showed up, all the conquistadors in the 15th through the 19th century, they had different intentions, you know. When they couldn't get done what they wanted to do with the Indians, with their own slaves or whatever, then they brought in African slaves, you know. But it's almost certain the same exact thing happened 2,000 to 3,000 years ago. These were multiracial migrations. There were very Semitic-looking people that they found etched in stone in Chichen Itza. There were Nordic blonde-looking people all over the Canary Islands and Mexico and South America. And then there was very black African-looking people, you know. So I think all the people that are, you know, that are trying to start this big race war, man, you should all be happy, you know, that ancient America was multiracial and multicultural, man. It was like, it wasn't necessarily bliss. They weren't all getting along, but they're not getting along now either, you know?
Well, exactly. I mean, you mentioned before, you know, Sumerians and Phoenicians, they kind of brought about their own destruction, you know, through the implementation of slavery. You mentioned that it was actually, that this also led then to mixing out and blending out of the different variances of people and whatnot. This, of course, happens in different phases and in different stages. And to a certain extent, I think that, I mean, it's very interesting to consider what is happening today with multiculturalism. But I mean, multiculturalism is something that only occurs in the Western world as well. It's only in Europe and America, Australia, and other white countries as well. And we're creating the same conditions in the Western world today that potentially happened way back then. And you mentioned that some people might actually have fled off. I mean, we see recollections in that in what we call white flight, for example, today. So is there a reasoning behind why this is happening right now? Is there a potential danger of the same thing happening here as what happened to the Guanches? Is something that's going to happen on a larger scale, or are we going to erode the unique, beautiful differences between the races altogether? Where do you think this is going to go, Gordon?
it's happening much faster now because of television and media, is that in ancient times, they didn't have mass communication like we do now. And a lot of the media conditioning is just really serious brainwashing. I mean, the way they try to level a playing field like this, I've been involved in agriculture and farming, and I've been involved in running a hostel. I've hosted thousands of people, probably over 9,000 people from all over the world. I have a lot of interaction with people from all different cultures, you know, Europe, South and North America, Africa, Asia, and I've talked to people, and I understand how Americans are conditioned and how Americans are trained and what the things that they believe in. And I have a pretty good understanding of what Europe's about too, and Australia, New Zealand. But the most desirable destinations in the world for anybody that's coming from a poor country, whether it's India or Pakistan or somewhere in Africa or Latin America or somewhere in Asia, their most desirable destinations are Northern Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada and the States. And so whatever was happening 2,000 to 3,000 years ago is happening now much, much faster because of mass transportation and television and mass communication and all this kind of stuff. But yeah, I think that essentially what happened before will happen again, and that if there's anything that would sort of be a kind of like a beacon of hope, it might be just the possibility that the Guanches did last so long. And if you look at what was going on in Europe and what's happened since then too, is that the culture of the Guanches, and at least the way they thought and the way they believed, could be kind of a, you know, a map for the future. You know, I know that these Indians, these Chepotule Indians in what they did at the Indians in Panama, we think, well, how did they manage to stay white in you know, for so many thousands of years? What it says was that within a given tribe, these white Indians at the Chepotules, they, when a, at the age of 13 or about puberty, the white Indians' children, if they were from a mixed union, some of the kids turned out white and they were required to go to the tribe of their white parents and raised as white Indians. And then the ones that were bronze or darker colored went with their brown parents, you know. And so that was how they stayed white through the years, basically. In other words, they just didn't mix, you know.
Right. Yeah.
And so that was why there was this white Indian tribe in Panama. That's how it was able to stay white for so long, because they didn't mix, or mixing was very minimal. And this tribe was very angry at the Panamanian government. This fellow, Richard Marsh, tried to set up a reserve for them. And he tried to get to some kind of a protection for them, but I don't think it ever really lasted, because the Panamanian government was doing horrendous damage to them, and they were sending police in there to attack them, and they couldn't go to the coast anymore. They had to hide out in the interior valleys because the Panamanian government was doing as much damage as they could possibly do to them and their culture. And I don't think they ever did last. But people wonder how they did last so long. I think it has a lot to do with our conditioning and how we're taught, what we're taught in schools, how they try to just kind of like level the playing field. I mean, when you look at the media, it's just ridiculous how they come up with what they call a level playing field, you know, and that they say that, you know, they put all of these people up there and they make it look like everybody's in happy union. We're just all sitting around the campfire singing songs, holding hands.
So right.
Makes me think about Darwin's theory of what they called natural selection versus artificial selection, with Charles Darwin, one of the most famous books in the 19th century, Origin of Species, where he's talking about natural selection versus artificial selection. And I think if you want to see artificial selection on steroids, the way people pair up with each other, just look at what religion and drugs have done to people in the military, in the media. I think the media is the biggest offender. I think the media does more offense for the way people pair up and the way they select their partners than religion or drugs and the military combined, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
These situations that are created. The way, when I talk to people, and again, I'm speaking as an American who's hosted over 9,000 people from all different parts of the world. And I see that it's very well known that only something like 5% of Americans even have a passport. You know, it might be as high as 8%, but it's very minimal. If you talk to 100 Americans, ask them if they've ever been anywhere, they haven't, you know. They've never traveled, they don't have a passport. If they've traveled, it's probably either through military tourism, where they've gone off to kill people, or it's from business travel or something. And so Americans are very insulated, but they believe what they see on television, you know, and they their cliches and their misunderstandings about foreign people in different cultures is because of their conditioning and the way they've been taught. And religion does the same thing, and the military does the same thing, and drugs completely destroy people. That's another thing that I kind of notice is that even Europeans that come over here, I don't know what they're doing at home. Maybe they drink or something like that, but everywhere they go in America, people are just always on drugs, you know? People are stoned on pot. You know, they're doing cocaine. They're into heroin and all kinds of stuff. Americans are just way more into drugs than Europeans are, it seems like, you know?
Yeah, yeah, and the not only to mention the pharmaceutical drug aspect to it as well, which is an equal, you know, problematic situation. But yeah, exactly. It's decadence. It's kind of a, I think it's a reflection actually of a rootlessness. I mean, what we're talking about here really in the bigger picture is heritage and tradition and culture and an anchor in something which is, you know, deeper and more significant than yourself. And I mean, sure, America was about 90% white before 1965 when the immigration laws changed, which is a tremendous demographic change just in 50 years with replacement level migration and everything else that's now taking place. But nonetheless, beyond that, you know, I think that America can be seen as a, you know, multicultural experiment. And if the result, although a lot of good things have come out of America, of course, but on the cultural front, I guess, in terms of how people feel and connect with things, then it's been a very sad experiment in my view. And it's very, it's a big shame that people are do not in America don't have more clear, you know, European traditional anchor to that extent. There's like there's not an interest in that. It's like people don't even, you know, think about that anymore. And I think that that creates a lot of issues and problems. And I think that a lot of the you know, the things that we do see with the drugs and you know, this kind of escapism, if you will, it is partially responsible due to this aspect that people don't consider a deeper connection both to the, you know, earth to a certain extent, but also to their own people, right? What would you say to that?
No, it's true. It's very true. I mean, if you're taught to hate yourself, if the moral midgets that are controlling this media sewer are teaching you to hate yourself, if every representation of you see of yourself is something negative, something from past or history is something negative, you're going to start to hate yourself. That means you're going to start to look someplace else for inspiration, whether it's spiritual inspiration or some kind of like, you know, cultural inspiration, you're going to look someplace else, you know. We've met, you know, like I get people from, for example, people from Australia and New Zealand, they love to travel and they go all over the world. As soon as they get 18, 20 years old, you know, they put on a backpack and they go around the world and they've never even seen Australia. That's one of the arguments that people use, you know, to me. They say, well, you know, America, people don't travel because America's so big. They go to Alaska, they go to Hawaii. And I say, well, you know, I've met hundreds of Australians that have never seen Ayers Rock or the Kimberleys, but they've been around the world twice, you know, before they're 22 years old. It's just part of their culture, you know, and that gives a person a pretty broad education, you know, to be able to see the rest of the world and what the rest of the world is like. But if an American is sitting home and the only time they've ever traveled is either through military tourism or just by looking at basically what they see on television, then they don't have a clue. And if they've seen nothing but bad things about European culture, about slavery and human sacrifice and whatever, and colonialism and all this stuff, and then all the legacy of South Africa and these colonies in Africa and things like this. You know, on the other end of the spectrum, we got German travelers all the time, and then we get English travelers, and the Germans don't have, I think, out of all the Europeans, people in Iceland seem to have a pretty strong sense of identity, you know. And I meet Icelandic people, and they're very proud of their language and their culture and who they are, you know. And I've heard you can even still hitchhike in Iceland. And probably a lot of Germans that like to go to travel to Iceland and visit there. And I would like to meet that kind of German, you know, because maybe they're interested in something Germanic and something that has to do with European culture. But instead, I meet Germans that come to California. And, you know, they're going all up and down the coast of California, doing whatever they're doing, traveling and stuff like this. And because it's so warm and sunny and beautiful in California, a lot of them want to settle here, you know. And what is their ticket to settling here? Well, it's either a phony marriage, like a convenience marriage, or a legitimate marriage. But it's not like a true loving romantic marriage. It's just like a gimmick to get in a place like America, you know. And the way the Germans do it, it's just all based upon some kind of moral atonement for the sins of the Nazis or whatever.
Well,
it's
exactly, like, yeah.
The Germans just like they pair up with with who they think is sacred and special and spiritual based upon MTV's brainwashing or something like this. I mean, it's like the value and the credit they give to people because of their ethnic background has to do with the avalanche of guilt that's been dumped upon them. It's so
yes.
obvious.
Yes.
The way the Germans act.
Definitely. And this is a false... I just wanted to mention as well, before we continue, hold that thought, Gordon. I mean, when you begin to analyze a lot of the history as well, you realize that a lot of it is actually fraudulent. And I think that there is no other historical event that has been more skewed than the Second World War and the fact that in Europe, you're not even allowed to question it overall. I think Germany is probably worst to this due to, you know, the alleged crimes of the National Socialists. And I think that this has been used very efficiently to begin to kind of erode and break down any kind of not only nationality, but just a kind of a cultural identity to the people, to your, you know, folk. And I think the Germans have been hit hardest on this front, definitely.
Yeah, no, they've been hit the hardest because I've sat down and I've talked with them for hours, you know, and we've been through these discussions about what it is they're doing. And if you talk to a German woman who's in her 40s and she's now living in California and she's divorced, and she'll tell you the truth. She'll tell you the truth of why she got married in a convenience marriage or some kind of a marriage. And even if she's got kids and all this kind of stuff, she'll tell the truth of why she did it. You know, it's some kind of moral atonement for the sins of the past, you know. And she doesn't feel good about who she is or where she came from. She wants to de-Germanize herself or whatever.
Yeah.
On the same level, this is going on with American kids that come from a European background too.
Oh, yeah.
But they're not talking very much. It's coming from the English and the Welsh and the Scotch. I mean, like I said, you can go through Europe and you can find some people, like the Icelandic people. I've met some of them, not a lot of them. So I don't know what's really going on in Iceland or Sweden or Norway and these kind of places. But I do see a difference. The Danes, for example, you know, most of the Danes that I meet say that, you know, they belong to Denmark. They like to travel, but they're not very common in California. You don't find the Danes coming here by the thousands, you know. They know they got a good deal in Denmark, you know. They got a pretty good deal. And a lot of Danes had never even driven a car or owned a car until they're like 30 or something. And they're going to medical school, you know, and this is very unusual. In America, people don't ride bicycles around, you know, like they do in Copenhagen. And this is very remarkable. And they're telling me about the immigrants that come to Denmark, they're required to speak Danish, you know. They don't live just
but,
like...
But this is changing now, too. I mean, sorry to interrupt there, but I would say, as a Swede myself, I mean, we have a tremendous amount of cultural Marxism that has hijacked our culture, and we've spoken both with Danes and Norwegians on the program as well that actually experienced this, for those who have, you know, their eyes open a little bit and actually questioning a lot of this. And true, there is a type of nationalism in, I'd say, Norway and Denmark, maybe even possibly Finland and Iceland, for sure, as you mentioned, beyond what you can see in Sweden. It's a very much of a self-hatred in Sweden, too. But the kind of nationalism or the pride that you see, I would say, to a large extent, is a kind of a facsimile. It's kind of a pseudo version of what it used to be, and it's a very welcomed aspect in these times to, you know, bring in a lot of immigrants into these countries and kind of welcome the erosion of your cultural identity and even assimilation into the culture, or even some kind of integration now to a certain extent has been kind of thrown away as well. Now it's like, No. Everyone who comes to the Nordic countries, they're meant to have their own culture within our country. So I don't know how much you've traveled around and seen this, but just to kind of give you an update on that this has changed radically quickly. And in the last 10, 15, 20 years or so, the Nordic country specifically has gone through a massive change. And I would say Sweden more than any of the other Nordic countries, for sure.
I would agree that Sweden way more, because I had a long argument with some Swedes about the subject of identity. And this was at a hostel, you know, and you could see that they didn't like some of the facts that I was presenting. In fact, it was interesting, right in the middle of this discussion I had, he did mention the Incas, of all things, you know, like, and I said, do you know who Bent Danielson is to him? And he'd never heard of Bent Danielson. He was the Swede that was on that Kon-Tiki expedition, you know. I said, you should pay a visit to the Kon-Tiki Museum. Go over to Oslo, Norway, and pay a visit to the Kon-Tiki Museum, you know.
Yeah.
See, this is getting right to the core of identity, you know, and he doesn't like this kind of stuff. He doesn't like even the remote possibility that a Swede could have been recreating a voyage that might have happened 2,000 years ago that has to do with something to do with his ethnic background or whatever, or this is some sense of pride in who he is. I mean, it's like you just bury it under the rug, and, you know, when you don't have any defense left, when the point of view that you have doesn't matter anymore, then you shift to offense. And the most offensive things you can do to somebody is either call them a racist or a homophobe or a Nazi or an anti-Semite. Those are always the
right
to supposedly win the argument. And I said, well, you've already lost the argument to begin with because you're not prepared for any of this.
Yeah.
So you don't have defense, so you shift to offense. And so we got nowhere, but he was a Swede, and definitely I have not seen anything that extreme from Norway or Denmark.
Yeah.
Places either. But actually, I don't know what's going on in any of these places, but I can guarantee that I've talked to some Danes that said that a lot of people ride bicycles in Denmark and that they don't even own a car, which is in America that would be unheard of, you know.
Yeah, well, it's a different layout of the cities and stuff too. I mean, you have suburban sprawl in America and you wouldn't be able to get somewhere without a car. Well, in Denmark you still have a good proximity, you know.
And I think you'll understand this. Like I said, I've lived in what was the Danish capital of America, which is Solvang, California. And I know quite a few Danes. I've met them. There's not a lot of Danes in California and America. They know that in Denmark, they got a good deal. You know, it comes up like on one of these Yahoo pages about the 10 happiest places in the world. And Denmark is almost always right at the top.
I would discount that. See, you know what? I'm gonna give you a couple of interviews that we actually did about this, about who actually is behind the happiest country in the world studies, and actually what some Norwegians and Danes think themselves about this. Sweden is ranked really high on that as well. And my argument there would be that it's actually a facsimile. It's a version that has been supplanted upon the people, and actually a very extravagant and successful propaganda scheme to even make the people themselves believe that they, to a certain extent, live in the West, you know, the best country of the world, while it's behind the scenes, it's completely crumbling and falling apart. The healthcare system, many of the things that we have been praised for in the Scandinavian countries, when it comes to education and healthcare and all these things that the greats of socialism was to bring us, right? Even if that was true for a little while, it isn't anymore. But this kind of rumor has remained to a certain extent, and I would say it's actually more about taking the Nordic model of doing things, of economics, a kind of a pseudo-socialist mixed with a corporate culture, and supplant that upon other countries, because I'm seeing how the Nordic model is being pushed, for example, on America, to have them believe that, oh my God, this is what we have to do, you know? And I see a great danger in that, and that's why I express some worry about that, because when you live in it, you know, unless you're, you know, you have to have your eyes open. I know that there's a lot of Danes and Swedes you talk to, and Norwegians, that don't question it in this capacity, and they are actually fooled by the propaganda, same way as you mentioned that people are fooled by the, you know, what they watch on the news and MTV kind of thing. So I would be careful before I go there. But what I'll do, Gordon, is I'll send you some of those shows and you can listen to them. We'll see what you think. Okay.
No, I'd like to listen to them, because I know that I noticed a huge difference between the Norwegians, the Swedes, and the Danes. I mean, believe me, I've met quite a few of all of them, and I know that the women are definitely treated very good in those countries. The women from Scandinavian countries like that are not, they're very independent, really. I mean, they're not afraid to go out traveling solo, and a lot of them do travel solo, and they've been around the world, and they have a strong sense of I don't know. I mean, they don't seem to get married too young ever. I mean, unless they have to come to America to get married to be legal here. Like, I'll give you a statistic. There's in Santa Barbara, California, I met a woman who is now divorced. She's in her 60s, and she's from Sweden originally. And she's kind of a local ambassador in Santa Barbara, knows all the Swedish people. Not an official sense, but in an unofficial sense, she's kind of a local Swedish ambassador in Santa Barbara. She said there's two Swedish men that live in Santa Barbara. There's 300 Swedish women live in Santa Barbara.
Yeah, and there's a reason why they've fled.
Well, supply, it fled, but also what kind of a deal are they getting, and why, you know? I mean, why is it Swedish women instead of some other women from some other part of the world? I think we know the answer to this. It's not hard to figure out, you know? But I don't think you'll find that same ratio with, like, Norway and Denmark. You know, I can understand why Swedish women would get such an offer and such a deal. And I've talked to a lot of Swedish men that have come here to California too and travel around here. And they tell me that a Swedish man is undervalued in America, whereas a Swedish woman is overvalued in America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. If she's young, You know, and so, and I think it's also true with most of the European countries. You know, if you take a woman from Germany, from Holland, from Norway, from Sweden, from Denmark, from Finland, and put her in a place like California, where there's 200 different languages in Los Angeles or something, and take a guy from any one of those countries, you know.
Yeah, oh, sure.
I guarantee you, the guy's value will sink. You know, if they're young in their 20s, the guy's value will sink. He won't be able to do that great here, but the girl's value will go up 20 times.
Sure.
She'll get offers for matrimony everywhere she goes, you know. And this, again, this is from media conditioning and brainwashing, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not a level playing field. It's just what Darwin's talking about, artificial selection instead of natural selection, you know.
Yeah, and it's like now we have, they talked about eugenics, and this is, of course, have gone a completely erroneous picture of so many things have in our past. This was just about being concerned about your offspring and procreation, but what we have today is dysgenics, not eugenics, you know. So this is it's a live experiment, really, of what we're seeing, of how particularly the Western world is kind of completely, kind of just blending everything up. It's kind of turning into cultural relativism, and with this, of course, you get a lot of problems with multiculturalism. And of course, now we can see in Europe with the increasing population of immigrants and Muslims specifically, that there is a lot of problems that arise from this type of behavior, unfortunately. And a lot of things lead to conflict on, you know, sometimes a religious basis, sometimes it's just on ethnic or racial basis as well. But I wanted to touch upon one more thing here, in terms of another sensitive area that people think that they are, that there are certain phenotypes that have, solo access to these historical events. But slavery, I mean, you mentioned in the book that the white Guanches actually were among some of the first casualties of the Atlantic slave trade, that were largely, you know, run by Arabs and Jews as well. This is actually alongside from blacks with from West Africa as well. But slavery is a huge topic in itself, and largely what's gone unrecognized here as well is, for example, how many Irish were part of the of being slaves as well. But it seems like it's only viewed from one area, because again, it goes back to what you mentioned before, because it's beneficial from that point of view of trying to level the playing field or whatever, actually put blame and guilt on Europeans around the world. So what would you say about the slave trade in this?
It's very true. I mean, the Guanches were, in the 15th century, they were the very first casualty. Even the 14th century, they were being grabbed way back by some of these Arab mariners and these people that went off the coast of Africa. They get into Lanzarote and Fuerteventura, where the islands are kind of lower and they're easier to get access. They'd grab anybody they could get their hands on and sell them as slaves. And they were Guanche slaves later on as it all started to collapse and they could grab people more. Guanche slaves were sent back to Spain, and Guanche women were sold as concubines and everything like that. They were turned into sex slaves all over the place. And so they definitely, historically, the Guanches would figure within that time frame of being some of the very first casualties of the Atlantic slave trade, definitely. And then you had, just the idea of it's, you know, just the concept of what slavery, what they're taught about slavery here in America, the general theme is that, that it is a racial issue, that it has to do with ethnicity and all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, knowing that guilt is a paralyzing emotion, and the more guilt you can dump on somebody, then it almost feels like there has to be some kind of reparations for this, you know. There has to be some kind of atonement for this, you know.
Right.
I see that there's a huge difference. To me, there's a huge difference between guilt and responsibility. You know, it's one thing to atone for the past and to recognize the past, but it's another thing to invent the past and to distort history and to suppress evidence and suppress information, you know.
Yep.
And also, the only thing worse than guilt would be shame. You know, if somebody's stuck in a mode of shame, then it's pretty hopeless, you know. And I see that this kind of thing, like I said on my YouTube comments, you know, some of these people were just, it started this hellacious war. I deleted some of them, but I left a lot of them up there, you know, and I put them into a folder. And once in a while, I go back and read them, and I can't believe some of these people must be taught this at universities in America, you know, and they're starting these wars with me.
Oh, yeah.
They have to do with somebody saying there was a 75,000-year-old civilization in Africa that was the genesis of all this kind of stuff, you know, and it was like the Sumerians were black and the Egyptians were black. And I mean, I don't know who's teaching these people, but they're probably getting funded by the government here in America. And they're teaching these people this kind of stuff. And I just can't believe somewhere within the walls of academia, this is what's going on. And it's no wonder people having to turn to the internet to get their information.
And yeah, I mean, this is Franz Boas. Look into him if you haven't already, and his political affiliations, and how they were seeking to use anthropology for political purposes and to break down, Western but primarily American society. And a lot of that actually hinges out of the very well promoted out of Africa theories and things like that. So you're definitely right. This is straight out from the universities. It's a very concerted effort that does, on a political level, connect with the Frankfurt School and some of these other organizations that have been inventing political correctness and everything else. So you're absolutely right.
Well, there were Native American tribes that held each other as slaves. It was very common before Columbus ever set foot on American continent. There was Native American slavery was going on, human sacrifice, infanticide. They act like it couldn't possibly be true, but it's been all over the place. This is the kind of anthropology that if you go up to the fourth floor at some university and you find these books that are just massive books, you know, that were written before 1940, and they're huge books. And if you really want to sink yourself into serious anthropology, go back and read books like that.
Yes.
And find out what history was like. I mean, everything from the 40s on, especially after the 70s and 80s, is just a sanitized, distorted version of history.
Yep.
At least what I'm seeing here in America for the most part. I mean, I've read some interesting books. There was one book I came across recently. Let's see. Called this Discovery of Mankind. It was just published just a couple years ago, about 6 years ago or something, by David Abulafia and Yale University Press. And he doesn't hold anything back. He's talking about these early Atlantic crossings, you know, and he mentions the Canary Islands quite a bit. And it's pretty well known that the Caribs in the Caribbean were cannibals, you know, these Indians that were in the cannibals, so that some of the first Indians that Columbus came in contact with had body parts cooking all over the, you know, Jamaica and Cuba and all these islands, you know. And I don't know how they can blame that on the Portuguese or the French or the Spanish or the British. They probably can't, you know. But they can probably say that it's just not true, that it has to be fiction or whatever. It couldn't possibly be true that American Indian could be a cannibal, you know.
Yeah.
But he delicately tiptoes through all of these paragraphs and passages through history, you know. And he's also talking about very white-skinned Indians, too, with beards and all this kind of stuff, that were, like, you know, mixed amongst these people and very black-looking people. I guess maybe you could blame them for the cannibalism. Maybe they were the ones that started. That's the only politically correct answer I can think to it all. But it's pretty obvious. It's a lot of these Indians were with war with each other. The Caribs and the Arawaks didn't like each other. You know, the Tainos and some of these people had things going on. They knew how to sail. They could get over to Florida. They could go to Venezuela. This is just the human population, you know. I mean, I don't know why they make it such into a racial issue and make it sound like they want to blame everybody that's the victor, you know. And,
yeah. David Abulafia, I'm reading a little bit about him here. Exactly. He's a British historian with a Jewish background. He's a professor of Mediterranean history at the University of Cambridge. But I bet people like Kevin MacDonald would have a thing or two to say about, this type of academic environment. And we've talked with some, professors in other universities around in North America specifically, that tell us how horrible the conditions are in most universities now. And it's a very, very strict environment where there is a very strong, centered line of what goes and what doesn't. And if you cross outside of those boundaries, you definitely get fired and you get ousted, just like Kevin MacDonald and some of the other people have done. So it's a shame. But what do you think will have to be done to kind of get some pride back and try to restore some of these historical inaccuracies that are keeping people in check, basically?
Well, did you say MacDonald got fired?
Kevin MacDonald, yes.
Oh, he did get fired. I didn't know that. No, I kind of know who he is. I haven't researched him a lot, but restore, I don't know. It's like what I published here was just basically, I thought it could be a map for the future in a sense. Is it like, there's a lot of different books, even the works that the Romans wrote, even things like The Conquest of Gaul by Julius Caesar and Tacitus Germania, you know, a lot of these old chronicles that were written by the Romans are a very good kind of an introduction to realize how hard people had it in Northern Europe dealing with the Romans and what the Romans did to Europe. So that's a pretty good point of entry, you know. You know, I mean, I've looked at the Icelandic sagas and some of these things, and they're interesting, but they're just too poetic and abstract to make any sense to me, you know. I've looked at a few other books about the Celts and the Teutons, and a lot of them are fascinating to me. I mean, but this kind of stuff is not widely available. You have to go on Amazon and dig for it. And once you start digging, you find there's references in some other books that they used as bibliographical footnotes and things like this. And within no time, you can accumulate a pretty good collection of books about what life was like, really seriously like, in ancient Europe, maybe 2,000-3,000 years ago, before everything started coming apart. And I always felt like everything that the Guanches were about, and even the Berbers in North Africa, should be included in that too, because they're kind of the same people, really.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And this is basically something that's innocent, something that's primitive, because I think the people that are searching for something a little bit more spiritual, a little bit more of a connection with something within the realm of the natural life, living on the earth, closer to the land and stuff, they're going to find it in these primitive cultures, and what better than a Stone Age culture, you know? And so that was my hope, was that maybe something like the White Indians of Navarra could serve as a map to the future, because we're still in an empire right now, and we're living off the fruits of America or the fruits of these first world nations. But a lot of us are really divorced spiritually from our past. We don't have any idea, you know, how to get back. And, you know, the separation from nature came so much sooner for Europeans. I mean, it was like things happened so much sooner for Europeans that we don't even have, our elders are not there, our grandfathers are not there, the scriptures aren't there, there's nothing there really. Yeah. You'd have to do a quantum leap back into prehistory. Interesting to note, I found Thor Heyerdahl's books to be some of the greatest books I've ever seen. And they're just magnificent pieces of literature, you know. I mean, if I know that he's controversial still, but they can't get rid of his books because they sold so many of them. If you go to a thrift store, there are just millions of them out there, you know. And
he does some magnificent work. You know, it's truly amazing. I don't think the full impact of his work has really been realized yet. To be honest, he's one of those guys who are like way ahead of his time, and I think in well, hopefully soon, of course, but probably even more so if academia develops some kind of honesty, at least they'll realize what a tremendous contribution Thor made, you know, to this kind of work.
Well, I've got two articles on my whiteindians.com called The Bearded God Speak, and the other one is Isolationism and Diffusionism, and they're taken from some articles Heyerdahl wrote in about 1972-73, and he had paraphrased a lot of this information in his book, American Indians in the Pacific, which was published in 1952. And The Raw Expeditions was published in the early 70s as well. And something like 2% or over 2% of the traffic on my website is from Israel. And I think that they've read some of this stuff. And there's always been this idea that the lost tribes of Israel are lurking out there somewhere on the horizon. And the Mormons are very much into this kind of thing too. And if you look in Heyerdahl's books in the index, you can see that he's talking about these prehistoric mariners as being very, very Semitic looking, you know, even in ancient Tahiti, even in ancient Peru and ancient Mexico. You know, this isn't about some Nordic gods or something. This is about these priestly castes of these people that belong to this solar cosmology, where very Eastern Mediterranean looking. Their faces are etched in stone, you know, they have very Semitic features, thin lips, long luxuriant beards, you know, very Semitic looking noses. And he went into great detail about this, you know, and this was what was happening at the time. And that was what I was trying to emphasize, was that the migrations that took place to set up these colonies in America and Polynesia and everywhere were composed of almost every ethnic type that you can imagine from the old world, from both Semitic to Nordic looking to African looking to just common looking Mediterranean people were spread all the way across the world, you know, 3,000 years ago, you know, and they mixed in, like, almost every person you meet nowadays of Mexican ancestry probably has all of this blood in their veins at some level, you know. And that's really the history of ancient Mexico and South America. It's just that you just have to dig a little bit deeper to find this. But yeah, in terms of identity, modern identity, getting back to the land and the source, you know, it's, we got to get some of this old literature in our collections and teach our children about this kind
exactly
of stuff.
Yes,
some gods of ancient Europe, what was going on in Scandinavia. You know, it's interesting how the Vikings, even though the Viking age was only a couple hundred years or whatever, 300 years, it gets the most attention because they always want to have something, you know, that's violent, you know, something like that. You know, it's like even if they're like 1,000 years before that or 2,000 years before that, people were living in relative harmony and they
sure.
were peaceful. And
yeah.
everything,
yeah.
Then it doesn't get as much attention as something that's violent, you know.
Well, exactly. I think there's multiple reasons for that, of course. Part of it, I believe, actually has to do with the tendency towards heroism and you know the deeds of the warrior and the fact that this is a component that is missing in our world today. A lot of you know our emotions are cramped up. We don't have a way to vent the frustration, and I think there's this kind of a longing back to a simpler period, but a more honorable period. And I think that this is one of the reasons. But I mean, obviously you're right. It's we've had civilizations for many, many thousands of years prior to the Viking culture, and this was just a very much later kind of reaction. I believe we talked about this on the program before with other scholars as well, that this was potentially most likely a reaction to the Christianization, and there was actually strategic points for why they you know raided some of the places that they did, and that because the Viking, which is a verb, it's something you do. You go on a raid and an adventure. You go Viking. That's what they used it for. But this was something that was actually outlawed in society, and it was not something that was encouraged. But I think in this particular period, they entered into it because they realized that they had to join up with the outlaws. They're more scrupulous, you know. Folk, if you will, that wasn't accepted into regular society because they realized that they had to retaliate against the expansion of Christianization of Europe, and this was a response to that. So I think there are logical explanations for why this occurred, and I think there's other logical explanations for why people are, you know, attracted to the Viking Age specifically, Gordon.
Yeah, well, that makes sense, and I think a lot of them were farmers too. You know, that they went on these raids and stuff, and they joined these mariner raids, and they were the first people in, I guess, recorded history anyway, to end up on four continents. You know, they were in
yep.
Asia, North Africa, Europe, and then they made it to Newfoundland and the New World. But it's been a question for a lot of people that, you know, did the Vikings go to the Canary Islands? Did they meet the Guanches? Well, what they would have found was a bunch of pagans, you know, at that point in history, in the year 1000, you know, the Vikings were living in the Stone Age, and they could have traded with them, you know, that might have happened. But I don't think they would have stood a very good chance against the Guanches, you know. Because the Guanches were, you know, they were prepared for anybody. You know, at that point in history, I mean, there was no firearms. And that's why the Vikings weren't able to establish anything in Newfoundland, you know, because they didn't have firearms in that year. But it was an unrecorded chapter in Guanche history. We don't know what happened between the Vikings and the Guanches, but it's very, very good possibility that the Vikings did visit the Canary Islands because they studied maps and they knew people. I mean, before them, there had been other mariners that were, even the Viking boats looked something similar to the Phoenician ones, you know. And so,
well, exactly. There's a large possibility that they would trade with them because a huge portion as well, by the way, of the Norse culture was not just raiding and pillaging, and as people are told, it was actually largely extent there was a trading. There were merchants, you know, the whole Volga trade route, and they, you know, brought up some incredible developments up to throughout Europe because of the, you know, the excursions they went on. So if they did visit there, and if they realized that these are people that are on a similar page and maybe even shared to a certain extent some kind of values of a more pagan lifestyle, it's very likely that they would have ended up, you know, trading with them in some regard.
Yeah, very likely indeed. I think that that was the typical pattern of the Guanches, is that they, when they first started meeting the Portuguese and the French and the Spanish in the 14th and 15th century, they were very friendly to them, almost too friendly, you know, and that it didn't take long before things started turning around. And so you can see that once the defensive strategies were put up, then it was just a matter of survival at that point, you know. But whatever came before that, including the Vikings, might have been much more benevolent.
All right. Well, very good, Gordon. This has been very interesting. I want to wrap things up here in a little bit. I just want to mention something to our listeners as well. That, you know, as we listen to some of these topics that we've been talking about, I think it's extremely important, folks, to connect, you know, with your roots and take the time to discover your pre-Christian heritage wherever you're from, and it will make you feel whole, you know, in a completely different way, and stop, you know, repeating and falling for the, you know, the media propaganda of the guilt and the shaming that we've been talking about here today. It's extremely important because it does affect your psychology. It affects how you live your life. And I mean, if you walk around with your head in shame, not much is going to be done, people. So, you know, look into the virtues, the nine noble virtues, and try to live according to those, you know, of a more pagan mind, if you will. I think that would do great. Be great benefits to you. But Gordon, please, if there's anything else you'd like to leave us with, you know, that please go ahead and mention that. And of course, give us the website again, give us the book title, and let us know if there's anything else you have out there, or if you have something upcoming here that you think people should know about.
Well, my website is whiteindians.com, and it has a link to a couple of videos on there, and you can get the book on Amazon. And what I found personally is that embracing this and kind of just having visited the Canary Islands and seeing all of this, I feel for some reason, having grown up in California my whole life, which is a land of palm trees, that I don't hunger for, you know, the fjords of Norway or the, you know, the green covered hills of Ireland or any of those places. I mean, I like warm climates with big mountains and oceans and stuff like that. And so it's almost like there's a direct, you know, spiritual connection between me and California and the Canary Islands, just because of the fact that, to me, that kind of a landscape is something that evokes the higher spiritual calling for me. Having grown up here and being a person of European descent in California, I look at a place like the Canary Islands and I see, now this is the Holy Land. Look at all of the things that happen here with these people. These people that were my cousins, you know, you could say that in a sense, in a form of soft inheritance, you know, the Guanches and the Swedes and the Germanic people and the Celtic people are basically all cousins, you know, they come from a homeland somewhere. We don't know exactly where. And I think it's important to say that we don't know, because there's too many people that are phony people that are telling you it had to be here, you know. But the original Indo-European homeland, we don't know exactly where it was. It could have been part of Russia. It could have been, you know, Armenia or the Black Sea or the Caspian, but it was probably somewhere in that vicinity. And the people got spread all over the earth. You know, they were way over in Polynesia even. Heyerdahl proved that there was these Arukahu, these people all over Polynesia. But I just get a strong spiritual connection when I think about the Canary Islands and the history that went on there. And I guarantee if you brought a Guanche back right now from one of those mummy tombs and you woke him up, say, hey, come, it's time to wake up, man. And if you showed him the Canary Islands now and you showed him to California, he would take California, because there's too many up in the Canary Islands. They cut down all the trees. They planted too many bananas and tomatoes and growing them with chemicals. They put in all these motels. You know, they polluted the whole place. But, or if you'd been able to grab, you know, a couple hundred Guanches in the 15th century and transplant them to California and dump them on the beach, they would have just formed a little community here and thrived, you know. But that never happened. And so, you know, I just think of kind of like soft inheritance, you know. It's like I don't have any family that ever came from the Canary Islands, but if you go back way, way, way back farther, you know, my ancestors are the ones that took off north and became Northern Europeans, you know, and some of the other ones took off west either by accident or design and became Guanches in the Canary Islands. And so,
right,
to me, that's a form of connection, just like way a Hopi or a Navajo feels some kind of a connection with an Aztec or an Inca or whatever, just because this is the way they're taught in their culture. And, you know, they're all part of a native tribe of some sense, you know.
Well, exactly. And you're right. And what you're pointing out in the book here is that people of European descent have this as well. We've just forgotten it. And it's very important that we bring attention to this for a sense of completion and belonging, I think, as well.
Yeah. And keep in mind, too, that the migrations in Europe were from south to north, and I think Harold was right about that. It wasn't like, you know, the people in Sweden and Norway just popped out of the ice or something. You know, they didn't pop out of the ice. There was nobody living in Northern Europe when it was covered with ice. It was completely covered with ice. And you can look up what year that might have been. Some people say it was 12,000 years ago, 15, 9. Ice ages came and went. But it wasn't a great place to live until the ice melted and retreated. You know,
there's one interglacial period, though, which I've been looking at recently. And I don't have that much information about it, but it points to around 40,000 years ago. And there are actually archaeological finds that have been done pretty much in central Sweden around one of the lakes there. And more work is being done on this right now. But that's an interesting thing, which seems to suggest a kind of a middle period here, kind of interglacial. But otherwise, beyond that, of course, I think that there are an extraordinary amount of finds and everything as well as that point to that the region is an ancient people there. But then the question is, of course, origins. This might go way, way back, you know, and we might be looking, as you said, at some kind of area around the Caucasus mountain chain, basically, where the origin point is. That, and then these later migrated up to Scandinavia. And I think that the temperatures, by the way, the climate was different in different times as well. And I think that you've had both migrations up to the north, and then you've consequently, I mean, just look at the 400-500s. AD, you see a tremendous migration from these areas and down to Southern Europe. So there's been a lot of back and forth, I believe, Gordon.
Yeah, exactly. And then anytime there's empires like the Romans have come and gone, they always can't keep up with their supply and demand. So then they have to bring in as many as 10,000 slaves a day, which is what the Romans did. And then it's just like America, you know, and the descendants of the slaves breed with the descendants of the slave masters, and pretty soon you have a new population 4 or 5 generations later, and then some people don't like what they see, and they want to get out and go someplace else and have a different life for their children, their futures. You know?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a good point. Think about it, folks, and it's something that's occurring right now in our global empire, as it were, and I think we'll see some interesting kind of reactions to this in some of the years ahead here actually as well. But whiteindians.com, that's the website. Go there and pick up a copy of the book, The White Indians of Nivaria, which is of course about the Comanches, and we're going to talk much more about some of these topics as well coming up, because there's a lot of interesting finds in terms of the Americas and everything else of what has been going on there with the Solutrians. That's something we're going to have upcoming on the program. But thank you so much again, Gordon, for being with us. This was very interesting having you with us. Keep up the good work, and maybe we can do it again in the future.
Thank you, Henrik. I really appreciate it.
Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening today. It's always great to have you with us. Coming up, Nora Gedgaudas, David Eberhard, Joy Camp, John DeNugent, Mike King, Kai Murrells, and Frank Salter. Tell your friends about us, and we'll be back with more here in just a few. My thanks to the hardworking team, and of course to you as well for being a member. We do appreciate it. I hope you have a great start on your week, and we'll see you online, okay? Take care. We'll talk to you later.